We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. How'd you guys do on the elections? Did your clowns win?
I made a lot of money. No.
I spent a lot of money. Yeah.
Oh, you must be one of those corporations that...
one of those anonymous donors who contributed millions to 501c4 groups, the groups that are not required to disclose their donors. It turns out in the Rossi and Murray election that Dino Rossi is the candidate in the United States that had the second largest number of 501c4 groups donations.
Who was number one?
I don't remember who the number one was. I want to say someone in Ohio, but because in Ohio the Ohio media market was just saturated with advertising.
Right. And they have three major markets as opposed to one.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. I want to say someone in Ohio, but Rossi, it turns out, received $5.4 million, most of it from Crossroads GPS, which is a group organized by Karl Rove that doesn't have to disclose who its major donors are. Outside groups in total spent nearly $11 million on the Rossi campaign versus about $8 million for Patty Murray to try to influence who was going to be elected to the Senate from Washington State. And what I found kind of interesting, if you look at Murray's contributions from 501c4 groups, she received less than $1 million versus Rossi's $5.4 million.
And remember that a lot of the talk when Rossi first got into the race in June, he entered the race relatively late, and the question was whether he could raise enough money to be competitive with Murray, because Murray already had a lot of money in the bank at that point. She'd been raising money pretty consistently throughout her six-year third term, and she didn't raise that much money in the last 6 months of the campaign. The later flowing money in the campaign almost all went to Rossi, particularly from the corporate sector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and we saw that, by the way, in the campaign itself. Rossi's ads were much more ubiquitous, much more visible than Murray's. And Murray didn't actually run, I thought, that good of a campaign. What she did have was a very good volunteer effort. And
yeah.
That helped get out the vote on election day.
A very good sort of knocking on doors, calling people on the phone to get out and vote. And we see that, too, with the voter turnout in the state of Washington nearing 70%, which I think may be a record for a midterm election.
Yeah, it is.
But what this Rossi-Murray race really points out is the Republicans shoveled money into the Rossi campaign, and Rossi still couldn't win in the state of Washington, which I think sort of proves his profound unelectability.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that he runs in 2012 against Rob McKenna for governor, and we can watch them during the primary beat each other up and compete to try and see who's going to appeal more to the crazy people
the
in the Republican
right.
base.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they're both way more conservative than they try and foist themselves off as to the general public. And, it'd be nice to have that teased out a little bit. And, Dino, you gotta run for something every 2 years. We miss you otherwise.
We expect it, yeah. At least every 4 years.
there were certainly a number of other interesting results out of Tuesday's election. On the initiatives, a lot of unfortunate news. Anything having to do with taxes and revenue went down in flames. Obviously, the economy being a major motivator there. 1053 is going to be a vote that I think people are going to regret in years to come.
That's the Iman initiative.
That's the Iman initiative that requires a two-thirds supermajority in order to get any tax or fee increase through the state legislature.
Yeah.
That also benefited from a ton of corporate money. Various corporations that were trying, out-of-state corporations, big oil and big banks in particular, who are trying to avoid state surcharges, particularly environmental cleanup in the case of supertankers, prompted a lot of big oil contributions to Iman's campaign. That's going to make it very, very difficult come the next budget in January, which is going to have a huge budget shortfall. It's going to be very difficult for them to raise any kind of money to help bridge that gap, meaning we're going to see massive, massive cuts on the budget come this next legislative session. It's not going to be pretty, and the results from this Tuesday pretty much guaranteed that.
Yeah, so with the candy and soda tax being defeated and then the initiative 1098 that would have taxed people who have higher incomes in the state of Washington with an income tax being defeated, jobs right, that's going to increase the budget hole, not just for the state, but also for the city of Seattle and other local municipalities, for counties, et cetera. But what was interesting is that, to me, too, is that the state could have lost yet another revenue stream, but they didn't with the two liquor privatizations bills going down in defeat. And I looked at those in addition to the defeat of the initiative that would have privatized the workers' compensation issue. I looked at those and I was just like, wow, what were people thinking when they went to the polls? It was very interesting. That was sort of a surprise to me to see those three all go down in defeat, in spite of the huge amounts of money that were poured into the campaigns for those initiatives.
And looking at the BIAW, they may Tom McCabe, who's the longtime leader of the very conservative Building Industry Association of Washington, may be forced to step down now. He's nearly bankrupted that organization with the bankrolling of 1082 and a number of the other initiatives that they've done in the past. They're really hurting at this point. Of course, they'll get other big money coming in to replace those funds, but they've really suffered as a result of their very aggressive attempts to skew law in favor of big business.
Yeah, and I mean, you can look at this in a couple of different ways. You could say that these initiatives went down in defeat because voters tend to vote no on things they don't understand or things that they don't trust. If they don't think they can easily predict what the outcome is going to be, voters tend to defeat initiatives. Or you could say that it might have something to do with more conservatives turning out to the polls.
Which is generally true in a midterm.
The
electorate skews older and it skews more conservative than it does in a presidential year.
And the opponents to all of these campaigns put up some pretty good advertising to argue against, you know, privatizing liquor sales because it could make hard alcohol more available to underage drinkers, and not privatizing workers' comp because, you know, of the evil insurance industry, et cetera. So, you know, you could say those are the reasons. And even though the electorate tends to be conservative and tends to, on an issue like privatization, to vote to remove services from the realm of the government and put it into the hands of business, it was very interesting to see these three initiatives go down.
Yeah. So to me, the two biggest takeaways from the election this time, and we'll talk a little bit about the national scene in a little bit, but, you know, number one was that this is our future in terms of the corporate money coming into campaigns. We've seen it in terms of the initiative process and how most of the initiatives this year were bankrolled by big corporations looking to enhance their bottom line. And we certainly saw it in terms of the campaigns for elective office in the post-Citizen United era. Record spending for a midterm this year, shattering all previous records by, you know, exponential factors. And those laws are
higher even than some of the spending that was done for the last presidential election.
Yeah, and
actually higher than. Yeah,
and this is going to be our new reality. The Democrats tried to pass legislation to counter the Citizens United decision during this past congressional session, and they couldn't even get a bill voted on because of Republican opposition. Now that the Republicans control the House, you can be sure that they're not going to advance any kind of reform for this. And moving forward in the future, Democrats are going to have to compete in that environment, so they're going to become more dependent on corporate money also. And that in turn is going to make them more dependent on corporate money in the future and less likely to try and reform that legislation. So this is going to be our reality moving forward. I never really thought that there would be anything that would make me pine for the days of erectile dysfunction commercials. But for the last week or so before the election, I was actually saying, you know, that wasn't so bad. So that's one thing to take away. But the other thing to take away, I think a lot of people, and we're moving sort of into the national results also, a lot of people are saying that they're feeling, you know, fairly discouraged that we're going to have gridlock in Congress, and you've got all these really crazy people in power now. Now is not really the time to get discouraged. It's the time to get to work. What we just saw in this election, particularly with the Tea Party, benefited a lot from all the corporate money and all the media help, but it was also the influencing of an election by a motivated grassroots movement. And, you know, that can happen on the left just as easily can happen on the right. It did happen to some extent in 2008, although not with an ideal standard bearer, because Obama, in many ways, is not a true progressive. But the desire that got him elected was by and large a progressive impulse. And that can happen, but only if people organize, not if people get discouraged and mope and get depressed and stay home and don't get out in the ground and start talking up the issues and talking up solutions for things like the economy and the wars and climate change and all the things that you know government is not going to address in the next 2 years and whatnot moving forward, because Washington D.C. is not constructed to provide solutions right now.
Yeah, and particularly now after this election with the Republicans in control of the House and the Democrats in control of the Senate, that I think we're going to see even more gridlock. And if anything, what irritated me a lot when I was reading a lot of post-election articles and hearing a lot of pundits talk is they were saying, oh, you know, this is a mandate for the Tea Party. You know, the Republicans have swept, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't see it that way because a lot of the exit polls showed that people who voted for the Republicans didn't necessarily agree with the majority of their policies. So what I think happened mostly is that there was a lot of grassroots organizing to get people out to vote, but I think it was mostly an anti-incumbent reaction, and I think we saw this as well. During the last presidential election, people were sick of Bush and sick of the policies of the Bush administration. They came out in support of the Democrats. I think this time people were sick of the last 2 years of gridlock, which they see as an extension of the 8 long and terrible years of the Bush administration. And they're just, you know, it doesn't matter whoever was the incumbent was going to have a hard time of it this year. That's how I kind of read it. That said, you have to remember in midterm elections, as Jobs said, a lot of the elderly turn out to vote. And we need to think about, okay, the last 2 years, what has it been like for the elderly? Well, they've seen the value of their homes decrease by as much as 50% in some parts of the country. And that hasn't, and they haven't come back, the value of their homes, which for a lot of folks is their retirement.
Yeah, and pension funds have been decimated too.
Yes, and the elderly tend to get by on their savings, and they tend to invest in a lot of fixed income securities like bonds, things that pay interest. And that's been actually the stated policy of the government, of the Fed and the Treasury, to keep interest rates low. Well, interest rates on those kind of investments are near zero now. So you have the elderly seeing their principal, the balance of their savings, dwindle at a rate they haven't seen in 20 years.
Meantime, the one expense that has defied the general lack of inflation in the economy is healthcare, mm-hmm. which continues to have double-digit inflation every year. That's the major expense for elderly people.
If yeah. you've paid off your house, you've paid off your mortgage and you have your house, it's your main asset, and you see it's worth a lot less and you're not getting anything on your savings and your healthcare costs are skyrocketing, you're going to be mad.
And healthcare reform hasn't done anything for you so far.
Yeah, not yet. And, you know, even if you don't believe, as a lot of the exit polls showed, a lot of people who voted Republican don't believe that healthcare reform should be repealed, even though that's a major part of the Republican platform. I take that to be because these are elderly people who are engaging in extreme anti-incumbent fervor.
Yeah, there was a priceless Tom Tolles political cartoon this week that showed a couple in a car sitting perpendicular in an alley, and the front end of the car is banged up, and the back end of the car is banged up, and the car is like facing one of the walls, right?
Right.
And the woman is like, "Let's put it in reverse again." that's pretty much where we are. The other thing that was very interesting to me about the exit polls was that we really saw the Democrats take it on the chin among the white votes. The Democrats did relatively well in multiracial districts. In fact, the Progressive Caucus of the House lost only 3 seats overall. A lot of the losses were in so-called, you know, for so-called blue dogs, more conservative Democrats coming out of more white, more rural districts. Those districts tended to vote overwhelmingly Republican, and that has to do also a lot with race and the narrative that the Republicans have constructed, that the Democrats are not interested in helping white people. They've got a black person as president. president, and they're all about being the party of minorities. And that's what you've seen with a lot of, you know, the Ground Zero Mosque, the Obama is a Kenyan and a secret Muslim. I mean, all these different stories that are seemingly ridiculous are all part of this narrative, designed to convince, white Americans that the Democratic Party is not of or for them. And I think we really saw the results of that on Tuesday among a sector of the electorate that would never, ever, ever cop to being racist. They just don't think that the Democrats are looking out for white people the way they should.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you have a lot of these candidates, particularly certain Tea Party candidates like Sharron Angle in Nevada, making statements that are just completely outrageous in terms of being overtly racist and not really realizing that they're saying these things that are offending people, and that, you know, they were punished for that.
Yeah. And that again gives more help for 2012, because that's another aspect of the presidential year voting, is that the percentage of non-white voters tends to go up during presidential years as well.
Yeah, one of the other very useful things that I saw in the post election analysis too was a big map showing who voted, you know, of the United States, showing who voted Republican and who voted Democrat. And of course the center, the vast majority of people who voted Republican was the center of the country, with a thin blue streak on the West Coast and a thin blue streak on the East Coast for folks who voted Democrat.
And then little dots around the country that tend to correlate very closely with all the major cities.
So you had this big rural-urban split in terms of who supported the Republicans and who supported the Democrats. And we seldom look at why it is that rural voters tend to vote Republicans and why, in this case, they voted for the smaller government candidates.
So Farm Girl, tell us.
Yes. There's this perception in rural communities that the government takes more from you than it gives back. Every time you open your property tax bill, for instance, and rural residents tend to own a lot more property than urban residents, that property tax bill makes you groan because you see that you're paying lots and lots of money to the government, and yet you don't perceive that you're getting very much back. However, studies have shown that rural communities tend to get a lot more in terms of dollar amounts, a lot more in benefits back.
I was going to say roads, electrification projects,
yes,
farm
schools,
bill, schools.
Hospitals, yeah, and clinics that, yeah, would never be able to be self-sustaining.
And they're all much more, you know, per capita, more expensive investments than they are in cities with more population density.
With a denser population, yeah. And in addition to the national safety net programs that are being referred to now in the media as well as by conservative politicians as entitlement programs, I call them safety net programs, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment, welfare, all the things that rural residents need as much as urban residents. And yet there's this continuing perception among rural residents that you just give me my guns and my family and my land and I'll be fine. Keep the government out of my business.
Actually, they needed more because rural areas tend to have less money than urban areas,
yes,
in general.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the one exception I would take to that is Social Security is not an entitlement program because it's originally our money. You know, it's an annuity, it's an insurance program, but it's originally our money and we're entitled to it back, by God. So yeah, it's an entitlement program.
The subtext being though, when you use the word entitlement program, that people don't deserve that money when,
right,
in fact people do. And the folks who need it really do need it.
Yeah, and in Social Security, it's our money to begin with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right. So let's move on then. Got just under 10 minutes left.
Okay.
Local, talk a bit about Metro.
Yeah, a couple of items regarding Metro Transit. This week we saw the release of a report from the 28-member Regional Transit Task Force. This task force was formed by the County Council to look at Metro Transit during a time of county budget cuts to see what could be done to save Metro Transit bus service, even though there's less revenue for it. They took 8 months to study the problem, and they've issued their report this week. Their biggest recommendation is that the county should ditch the 40-40-20 rule for new service. That 40-40-20 rule means that 40% of new service goes to East King County, 40% goes to South King County, and only 20% goes to the city of Seattle, where most of the riders are. And in addition, Metro Transit operates on a 60-20-20 rule for cutbacks, meaning that 60% of the cutbacks go to the Seattle routes where most of the service is, because cutbacks are spread out evenly over the system. 60% of the bus service is in Seattle, so Seattle gets 60% of the cuts, but only 20% of new service. So the report recommended you got to get rid of those two rules, and the county council and Metro Transit need to work together to come up with a new and transparent policy for service changes based on population density, where jobs are located, the integration of Metro Transit routes with other transit agencies, and geographic coverage.
Yeah. The other factor that needs to be taken into this also, particularly with the McGinn administration in the city, you're seeing a lot of policies that are being generated around the concept of just discouraging car use. And discouraging car use makes a lot of sense from an environmental standpoint, but it doesn't make sense from a transportation standpoint unless you're taking some of the resources that would have gone into, bankrolling and providing the infrastructure for car use and putting some of that money into public transit instead. And right now the money that's being saved, that's not being spent on cars in Seattle, is being spent instead to, when it's used at all to expand public transit, it's being used to expand public transit in the suburbs, which it makes no sense at all. It leaves people in Seattle who need options to automobile travel aren't getting them.
Yeah, so the report is basically saying demand is higher in the city of Seattle, population is growing faster there, and we're just not getting the service to deal with that. So that was their lead recommendation. They also said a couple of other things as well and most important, among their other recommendations, is that Metro needs to continue to look for reductions in their overhead costs, their administrative costs, and internal.
I think that's probably going to be a plaque in a lot of offices now.
Yeah.
All right.
Additional information for Metro. Some good news for Metro this week. They received a couple of grants from the Federal Transit Administration, $4.7 million to test a prototype electric battery-powered bus, and which would not operate on the overhead wires that the current electric buses operate on, but would have a battery in it, and it would plug into recharging stations. A type of bus that's very popular in other countries of the world, particularly in Europe, but it's brand new for the United States, and Metro Transit is one of the first transit agencies to get a test project going on that. And also a $6 million grant to buy hybrid diesel electric buses to replace the old diesel-only buses. So some good news for Metro this week as well.
All right. Jumping into national and the Department of Justice getting involved in our genes.
Yeah, in a friend of the court
brief. I beg your pardon?
Not in my genes, thank you. In a friend of the court brief, the Department of Justice this week said that genes should not be eligible, particularly human genes, should not be eligible for patents. This was a very surprising ruling, given that the Patent and Trade Office has issued thousands of patents on genes. About 20% of the human genome has been patented so far. Merely isolating a gene, the Department of Justice said, merely isolating a gene doesn't change its nature. Therefore, it should not be subject to a patent. This came in a lawsuit by the ACLU, the Public Patent Foundation, medical researchers, and medical groups who were challenging patents held by Myriad Genetics and the University of Utah Research Foundation, particularly patents on two genes that are implicated in breast cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2. In March, a judge in the U.S. District Court in Manhattan ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, saying that, yes, those genes should not be patented just because they can be isolated by this new process developed by Myriad and the University of Utah, that, in fact, the genes themselves are natural and should not be subject to patent. Of course, Myriad and the University of Utah are appealing that.
Yeah, that's a huge international issue, by the way, because you get a lot of indigenous groups that are finding that, their own genomes are being patented and ownership claimed of them by essentially colonial exploiters. It's the new form of neocolonialism.
Yeah.
Where you have these massive corporations from the West coming in and trying to exploit indigenous resources.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And moving on to economic news and QE2.
QE2, yes. QE2. This week, the Fed announced a second round of quantitative easing. We've talked about that in the last few weeks. Nicknamed QE2 by European bankers and economists. The Fed said that they will buy $600 billion of long-term treasuries, which actually, it turns out, are more closer to medium-term treasuries, about $75 billion a month. In essence, they're printing money to lower long-term interest rates. This will do a couple of things. Supposedly, the Fed is hoping it will raise stock prices because investors looking for any rate of return will stop buying treasuries and start buying stocks. That's the theory. And that's supposed to make people spend more, the idea that the value of their stock is going up. However, the Fed hasn't taken into account that not very many Americans hold stocks, and particularly people who are unemployed or whose homes are being foreclosed on. Those are not the folks who own a lot of stocks. In addition, stock prices have fallen so far that it's going to take a while for them to recover their former value, and it's not going to be anytime soon, certainly not soon enough to stimulate the economy.
And is there any evidence that rising stock prices actually stimulates the economy? Because people tend not to spend that money, do they?
Well, they don't spend that money, but the idea is they feel wealthier because their savings are bigger, and so then they go out and spend their disposable income instead of simply holding it in the bank. I'm not convinced that that actually works, but there's another problem coming out of QE2 as well. It's starting to spark trade and currency tensions with other nations. In other words, printing more U.S. dollars means a weaker dollar, means the value of the dollar goes down, and other currencies become stronger, their value increases. It means that other countries' goods then become more expensive for U.S. consumers to buy. And since we're the world's main consumer, except for China, and China's currency is held on a peg, it means the Chinese government keeps the Chinese currency artificially low so that their goods can be cheap on the world markets, but that means that their consumers can't afford to buy as many imports. We're the world's main consumer, and if our currency can't afford to buy current goods from other companies, that means international inflation, and that's not making other countries very happy right now.
All right. Finally, only a couple minutes left. The initiatives, California.
Yeah, a couple of results from California that were one was encouraging, one was not. One was that there was an effort in the California ballot this year to overturn California's landmark legislation regulating greenhouse gas emissions. Big oil and gas and energy companies were spent a lot of money into trying to get it overturned, and it went down in flames, natural gas flames, no doubt. 75%. I haven't seen the exact final figures.
Wow.
But a very, very large section of the electorate, and mind you, this is California, not Kansas, but still, is in favor of trying to do something about climate change. So even though you have this obstructionism going on at the national level, as Maria said when we were talking about the election earlier, it's very encouraging in terms of there being public support for local initiatives, and that's something that we should take to heart in Washington State moving forward in terms of things that we try and do here about climate change. The other result that has an impact on what's going to be on the ballot in the next year or two in Washington State is the decriminalization of marijuana initiative that did not pass in California. It went down by about 54-46% there. There will almost certainly be a similar initiative in the ballot in Washington State. There are two different groups, one trying to put it on the ballot next year, the other trying to put it on in 2012 here in Washington State. And you can be sure they'll be looking at the California initiative and what went wrong there in terms of, the generic question in polls, people tend to support legislation, but are they voting differently when they get into the ballot box, or were there specific things about the way this was worded and California's experience with the dispensary system, that would be different in Washington State? So, lessons will be learned there that will be, applied here in the next year or two.
We hope.
Talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is where you find all the latest stories, the analysis, the humor, the blogs, all the calendar of events, all that good stuff. Check it out, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, we are looking right now for an editor and for a calendar editor. So if you can be a volunteer who would like to help out with either one of those, let us know. Email us at editorial@eatthestate.org. So drop us an email at that, editorial@eatthestate.org.